This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Within days of both waves of bombs in London, television screens around the world flickered with images of the suspects, grainy pictures taken by some of the estimated 6,000 security cameras in the London transport system. They proved crucial to identify the suspect for the suicide bombers of July 7th and formed a most wanted backdrop at the police news conference held after the failed bombings 2 weeks later. Assistant Commissioner of Metropolitan Police, Andy Heyman.
Do you recognise any of these men? Did you see them at the three underground stations or on the bus? Did you see these men together before or after the incident?
Police now say that all four suspects are in custody. CCTV, closed-circuit television cameras, are nothing new, but around the world, security professionals are urgently adapting systems originally designed to track traffic jams and prevent petty crime to the fight against terrorism. It's already clear they can be useful to investigate attacks. Can they prevent them? And at what price? Over the next few weeks, we'll hold a series of discussions on the tools to fight terrorism, profiling, public diplomacy, intelligence sharing. Today we start with surveillance cameras. Later in the program, we'll look at how the controversial appointment of John Bolton to represent the U.S. at the U.N. will play out at the United Nations. And baseball's steroid testing program catches a major star. But first, security cameras. Conversation about video surveillance has long been a risk-benefit debate between their value fighting crime and their intrusion into our privacy. Does London change the equation? If you have questions about how police, transit systems, and private companies use these cameras, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. To tell us more about the use of closed-circuit television, or CCTV, in Britain, we're joined now by Martin Gill, Professor of Criminology at the University of Leicester, and it's nice of you to join us today on Talk of the Nation.
Good to join you, too.
Take us through how the cameras in London work. How did the London police track down the images of the four suspects from CCTV?
Well, in this case, the operators were slightly fortunate in the sense that in most crimes, they don't have so much information to start with. Here, they knew the place where the crime took place, and very soon they knew the locations, obviously, and very soon they knew the identities of the people concerned, so they knew who to look for as well. So in this one, it was comparatively easy to track the people concerned, and that's not always the case.
Well, the police looked at these images, obviously, after the fact. Before an attack happens, who's watching these cameras?
Well, theoretically, there may have been an operator watching some of the cameras, but they would have had screens in front of them that contained hundreds of cameras flicking on in and out of the screens. And the trouble is, when you look at these, all you can see are scenes of people moving about. There's nothing particularly unusual. And, of course, the bombers would easily have been able to blend in because they weren't doing anything out of the ordinary in terms of getting on the underground with a rucksack and getting on a bus with a rucksack.
We would call a backpack in this country.
A backpack, okay.
Yeah, that's all right. Does smart software identify suspicious behavior or packages?
Well, yes, it can, but not in this context. For example, there is software on the underground which can indicate when a bag's been left in a particular location for, say, a minute and a half or 2 minutes. If it hasn't moved, it will draw the operator's attention to that fact so they can investigate. But, of course, there was nothing unusual about the activity of these bombers.
It's been mentioned, and there was a clip of tape we had from a British Transit Police officer a few moments ago, that these CCTV cameras did help deter terrorism in the case of the Irish Republican Army, who would leave bombs and then find that their pictures had been captured on these video cameras.
Yeah, it's certainly the case that people who have committed very serious offences have been caught on camera. But I spent a lot of time talking to offenders in prison, and I've taken them back to the scenes of their crime and got them to talk through with me how they get around security. And by and large, it's true to say that cameras are a threat that can be managed. They don't look at them, they look away, they wear disguises, various other things, which obviously it's best not to go into too much detail about.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a great threat. And, of course, we do know from shopping malls and other places that even though they've got cameras, crimes still take place. So I don't think it's a great deterrent, although it might deter some, Where it does come in to be a strength is, of course, in after the event investigation, where they are able to build up a picture of what's gone on after the event.
And we saw that even here after 9/11, the video images, creepy in retrospect, of the hijackers going through airport security, buying gasoline, that sort of thing.
Yes, another classic, of course, where the images were useful after the event, but of course they didn't stop the offenders committing the crime in the first place. And there's a lot of stories like that, I'm afraid.
We've heard that there are over 500,000 surveillance cameras in the City of London. Put that into some kind of perspective for us. Are they networked or focused only on public areas?
No, they're focused on more than public areas. In this country, the British public welcome cameras to such an extent that they're now in residential areas too. So you could go into estates and find that cameras are looking all over the estate. And these are often very welcomed by the population. We're in a country where cameras are loved, I'm afraid.
Let's get some callers involved in the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And we'll begin with Michael in Columbia, South Carolina.
Good morning, or good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
I don't have a problem with cameras in that, to me, it's taken the place of a human being, whether it's a private security guard or a police officer, who could stand in that same place and look at people and look at what's going on and take stock of that in his or her mind and then either react to it or not, or scan your face and compare that to his memory of his or her memory of wanted posters. Mm-hmm. And why that is a privacy issue. You're standing in they're not looking inside the blinds of the window of my home. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about being in a public place, whether it's a shopping mall or an airport or a mass transit subway station, whatever. And well, I just don't have a problem with that myself. That doesn't concern me.
Martin Gill, let me ask you about that. Are security cameras in some respects a replacement or augmentation of the police?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt at all that they've been seen to be that. But there's a real problem in practice here, in that although cameras are all over communities, one of the problems that occurs is when an incident does take place, the public, naturally enough, expect that someone will be watching what's going on, they'll contact the police, and a police officer will attend. And in the majority of occasions, that's not what actually happens. Partly because people don't notice what's going on because there are too many cameras and they can't watch every screen at the same time. And even when they do spot something, it's not the case that they tell the police and they automatically arrive, because sometimes it can be quite remote areas. Sometimes the police are busy on other matters. And this has led in some quarters to dissatisfaction with the cameras, or at least a belief that they're not quite as good as they thought they would be.
Hmm. Michael, thanks for the call.
Yes, thank you.
Let's go now to John. John is calling from Scottsdale, I suspect, Arizona.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Hi. Great show. I had a primary question was, who watches the watchers? How do we know that the information collected is handled properly?
And what do you mean by handled properly?
Well, I mean, how do we know what's being collected, really? You've got a network of cameras everywhere, and it sounds very Orwellian. I think everybody out there would have a question as to what's being done with that. And so basically, who is watching the folks that are using these cameras and networks of cameras, make sure that it's used properly?
Martin Gill?
Yes, very, very good question. It's an issue of major concern here. Just to let you know, there are some technical ways in which people could be checked up to see what they've monitored, but they are regulated here, and they are expected to obey those regulations, such they can only monitor people in a certain way, and they can only keep their focus on someone with good reason over a certain period of time. But it is sometimes abused, and people have been dismissed for abusing them.
Excuse me, Martin.
And it's a problem.
What would constitute abuse?
Well, for example, they could, if they were focused, if it was a male operator focusing on pretty women, focusing on what they do, if they focused in a area on a residential house, trying to look through the windows, that could be done. They would constitute abuse.
Or if they were using it maybe to even scope out opportunities for criminals, presumably that would be abuse. John, are those the sorts of things you're worried about?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, where are the limits to that if we are to avoid a sort of Orwellian surveillance state where cameras pop up everywhere and end up maybe in front of our lawns or homes?
Let me just tell you one of the incredible thing about the UK here, because I've been in various control rooms where the control, that's where the, all the cameras are watched from. It's called a control room, where the manager of the control room has been concerned because cameras could see into properties. So they've contacted the people and let them know. And in both the examples that I witnessed, the members of the public were quite happy for the cameras to look in as far as they were concerned to increase their safety. So we haven't got that great concern about what cameras can do here yet. It remains to be seen whether that faith and enthusiasm retains over time.
John, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And before we let you go, Martin Gill, clearly these capabilities with computer software and networking will only improve over time.
They will. I think the problem from my point of view is not the capability of technology, which is amazing. The real problem is humans using it to maximum advantage. And I think we've got a lot to learn yet about how we maximize the use of all types of technologies, and CCTV is certainly one to be included in that way.
Mm-hmm. These, by the way, are expensive pieces of equipment. Who paid for all those half a million cameras in London?
Various ways, but the government of the UK put a lot of money into it, a successive government of both types, over many years, because they believed it to be a silver bullet. They believed it to be a way in which you could make communities safer. It's questionable whether that's happened, but of course it has provided us with images that can help investigate after the event.
Does it make people feel safer?
No, not really. We've just done a major survey, 4,000 members of the public. Cameras did help in some cases, but the experience of living in an area with cameras is that they weren't quite as good as they thought they would be. When you realize that when you begin to see how the cameras move and you don't notice a reaction when there's problems, and of course when the police don't turn up when there's a problem, you begin to realize that something not quite right here. So it's not that they haven't got a very good function, it's just that maybe the value's overstated. It's good in theory, but the reality is somewhat different.
Martin Gill, thanks very much. Martin Gill, a professor of criminology at the University of Leicester. We spoke with him from his home in England. When we come back, we'll bring the story into this country. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The British are the most photographed people on Earth, thanks to the enormous number of security cameras that we were talking about last segment. The cameras obviously did not prevent last month's bombings. They've proven vital, though, to the search for the men involved. This hour on Talk of the Nation, we're considering the usefulness of closed-circuit television in the prevention and investigation of terrorism. Of course, you're welcome to join us. What are your questions about the role cameras can play? Are they important enough to be worth giving up some of your privacy? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Last September, Chicago became the first American city to link together its existing surveillance cameras using new technology and smart software. The city hopes to use its system of 6,000 cameras to deter crime and fight terrorism. Monique Bond is spokesperson for the Chicago Office of Emergency Management and Communications, and she joins us now by phone from her office in Chicago. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon.
How's the new system working?
Well, you know, it's working great. Let me just talk a little bit about Chicago's Unified Camera Surveillance Network, because it really does have a multi-layered approach of integrating our day-to-day city services like public safety, traffic management, and homeland security under one surveillance roof.
Now, are those two systems linked?
Yes, they are. Basically, the purpose of the city's Unified Camera Surveillance Network is to monitor and direct city services in response to Homeland Security, public safety, and traffic management incidents. And using this fiber network, our surveillance technology is linked to the city's Central Operations Center, which allows emergency management personnel to view recorded or real-time video while controlling the operation of the cameras and other linked infrastructure.
They can move the camera up and down, left and right, to look at various things in real time. Can they then transmit those images to a police car?
Yes, they can. In fact, one of the things that we're looking at, one of the technologies that we're looking at, is to have that wireless system fed into the patrol cars that are out on the street.
And I understand that the latest cameras there in Chicago, some of them can respond to the sound of gunfire.
Some of them are equipped with advanced technology such as the gunshot detection and motion sensors.
So we're
really looking at this next generation technology to add to our existing camera network.
No system of cameras is any better than the number of people monitoring those cameras. What's the ratio of eyeballs to cameras?
You know, that's a very good question. The ratio of eyeballs to cameras is actually, it doesn't require as many bodies or eyeballs to monitor the cameras because of the ability for the locations to be captured on a wide monitored screen at the city's operations center. So we have about 30 bodies that actually monitor different various locations throughout the city, mainly our critical hotspots. Also, the police departments have the capability in their police stations to now monitor the cameras that are located within their districts.
How are people in Chicago responding to this increased scrutiny?
You know, we've got the positive response from the communities tells us that the cameras are working. We can't put them up fast enough. And, for example, our police pod cameras basically rotate from neighborhood to neighborhood depending on the reduction or the increase of crime reported. So we know when a camera has been relocated based on the flood of calls that are coming in with people wanting to know why their camera's missing. So we've gotten a very positive response from the public.
Mm-hmm. Have they been instrumental in prevention of crime, in the solving of crime?
Basically, yes, they have. The prevention of crime they have recently, we were able to capture on video a suspected narcotics transaction on the sidewalk of one of our notoriously known drug dealing operations. So we were able to capture a multiple hand-to-hand transaction during a period. So that was one of our first. So they do work. Obviously, we will never know if there's been any evidence of preventing a terrorist attack. Maybe we have, but what we can do is try to reduce our vulnerability by continuing to implement these technologies.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Scott. Scott, with us from Wyoming, Laramie, Wyoming. Excuse me.
Yes, that's true.
Go ahead. You're on the line.
Well, my comment was about the privacy issue, and it seems like if you're on the subway, such as in London, there's really no privacy to be had because that's a public place. Now, you can't put the cameras in bathrooms, of course, because then you're constituting, like, a privacy issue. But if you're out in public, and the best part about the cameras is that there's no such thing as, like, a biased camera. You don't have cameras racially profiling people. The people that are watching those films can do that, but a camera's unbiased. It's going to catch everything that happened. And with what happened in London, it'll eventually see the people who did it.
Mm-hmm. So, Scott, you've got no problems with it as long as they're in public spaces.
Well, in residential neighborhoods, it's fine as long as you're not looking in people's bedrooms, like the previous caller said. But it seems like public places are public places, and there's no privacy issue there. It seems like a safety issue more than privacy.
Has this come up at all in Chicago?
Scott, there is a delicate balance between public and private spaces, but our cameras are all in the public way, and our emergency management personnel as well as our police officers are trained to respect First and Fourth Amendment privacy rights before they're even allowed to monitor a camera.
Oh yes, and I understand that. But as long as, like I'm saying, if you're on the subway, you're sitting in a subway car, there's no privacy issue there, unless they're trying to look in someone's handbag. And even then, it seems to me like you're skirting the line between public safety and public privacy.
Mm-hmm. Scott, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, Neil.
Monique Bond, are these cameras in any way linked with, obviously there are a lot of private companies that use cameras of various sorts in the city of Chicago. I assume there's one over every ATM machine.
Certainly the private firms have their own camera surveillance network, but, you know, members of the private and financial services sector have approached us to bring their private camera feeds back to our city's operations center for integration into our 911 emergency operation. That's one of the things that we're looking at in augmenting is basically the calls into our 911 dispatch. So.
Mm-hmm.
A 911 call taker or dispatcher will be able to lock in on images where active emergencies are taking place. And so we've gotten a lot of response from our private sector, financial services sector, to be able to tie into that.
What did this system cost?
Homeland Security grants, it's an evolving number to start with the beginning of our program, basically in the $5 million range. However, it continues to grow, and we continue to apply for Homeland Security grant dollars. Also, we use, for the police pod cameras, drug forfeiture dollars. So they basically, the criminals are paying for their own cameras.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Russell. Russell calling from Reno, Nevada.
Yes, hi. Thanks for having me.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
I was curious. I've heard of programs that actually take a map of the face, so to say, in as far as facial features, to track, say, registered sex offenders, convicted felons.
I think it's called facial recognition software.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. I was wondering, is that being used currently, or is that going to be used in the near future?
Monique Bond?
One of the things that we're looking at, all types of technology, facial recognition, biometrics, sensors, gunshot detection, all of those kind of next generation technologies are eventually going to be integrated onto our fiber optic grid. And, you know, we're going to continue to push the envelope for even more advanced technology. So those are certainly some of the technologies that we're going to be looking at. Some of them we already have. Some of them we can't really talk about, but a lot of them we are certainly looking at and also increasing.
What are the ones that you have that you can talk about?
Right now we do have the gunshot detection, motion detection, and some biometric capability in some of our city locations.
Biometric capability?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
For example, I can give you an example. One of our in our 911 facility, there's, you know, in order to enter the building at any one of the access points of, or the doors of the facility, you must have a fingerprint to allow you access and entry into or through a door.
Hmm.
So that includes all employees and anyone coming into that building. If you do not have an identification card that also has your fingerprint programmed, you won't have access into the building. And that's one of the things that actually our mayor is looking at integrating into our entire city department network.
Hmm. That's interesting. Russell, thanks for the call.
Thank you very much.
And finally, an email question, this from Mike. Why not make these video streams available to the public? Allowing the public to watch these same images would greatly increase the eyeball-to-image ratio. Obviously, there's a lot of places you can turn on your TV and watch the traffic video cameras to see what traffic is like on the Washington Beltway, for example.
That's exactly one of the things that we're looking at, particularly with our traffic management authority. We have also something called red light cameras. And basically what that is it's able to detect a motorist who has run a red light at a certain intersection. And oftentimes we have motorists that call and want to have a copy or be able to see exactly what time and when, if they actually ran the red light. And so that's one of the things we're looking at integrating onto a website so that they could have that access.
Monique Bond, thanks very much for taking your time today.
Thank you.
Monique Bond is spokesperson for the Chicago Office of Emergency Management and Communications, and she joined us from her office in Chicago. For a bigger picture, so to speak, on the role that surveillance cameras play in daily American life, we turn now to Greg Hull, Director of Operations Safety and Security at the American Public Transportation Association. He's been nice enough to join us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in.
Well, thank you for the invite.
We just heard about Chicago. Where do other American cities stand in terms of surveillance cameras?
Well, surveillance cameras have, in fact, been used in public transportation across the United States and throughout North America since the 1970s. And as you might know, within our industry, because of the large numbers of people that use public transit every day, there are over 32 million trips that are taken on public transit. We are, therefore, by need and by design, an open infrastructure, and that presents some pretty unique challenges for security. And the base for security really is with people, plans, and procedures. And onto that, we then layer technology such as surveillance equipment. But as I indicated, we have been using surveillance equipment since the 1970s. when we had the older analog systems, the tape systems, particularly in stations. And it was in the early 1990s, we started to see more transit systems begin to use surveillance equipment, cameras on board buses and trains as well.
Now, remind us, a lot of people see cameras out every day in public, but the majority of those are not owned by the government or run by the government, are they?
No. The cameras that are out in the infrastructures of public transit are, in fact, owned by those public transit agencies. They are paid for by local, state, and federal funds that are available to the transit systems, as well as funds that come to the transit system through the fares that we all pay.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I understand it, some of these systems were set up by transit authorities to begin with to try to prevent vandalism, a petty crime, graffiti, that sort of thing.
Exactly. We know through the experience that surveillance equipment does in fact deter crime. It deters the incidence of graffiti. It deters thefts in stations and on board trains and buses as well. We also know that it helps to mitigate against insurance claims, false claims that might be made against the transit agencies. And in fact, there's a return on investment simply through the deterrence of and mitigation against insurance claims.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about surveillance cameras, their growth, their use, and their effectiveness as a deterrent or preventive or as an investigative tool for terrorism. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now is Brian Jenkins, senior advisor to the president of the RAND Corporation, also director of the National Transportation Security Center at the Mineta Transportation Institute in San Jose, California. He's with us by phone from his office in Santa Monica, California. Nice to talk to you again, Mr. Jenkins.
Thank you.
How do surveillance cameras fit into the broader issue of homeland security?
Well, they're just one of many pieces of technology that are being deployed, all of which are determined to improve our abilities to conduct surveillance, to detect activity that may be going on. Cameras are the most advanced. The more experimental things have to do with chemical detection systems, biological detection systems that have been deployed in some places on an experimental basis.
And we were talking earlier about some of the facial recognition software. That kind of thing may be in the future.
Well, the cameras over time are going to get smarter. They're going to get smarter in a number of ways. They're going to be able to react, whether they react to motion, that is, detecting people moving where people should not be, or, as Martin Gill mentioned in your earlier conversation, detecting things that sit motionless for too long and thereby raise suspicion as an abandoned parcel or potentially a bomb that has been left. They're also going to get smarter over time. There's software that's being developed so that they can detect anomalies. That is, the camera and its software, over a period of time, if aimed at a specific location, will very quickly come to recognize what are the normal patterns. And if there's a deviation from that pattern, then we'll alert someone at a monitoring screen to take a look at that. For example, if a camera were focused on a one-way highway, it would quickly instruct itself that all of the vehicles are supposed to go one direction. A vehicle going in the opposite direction would immediately provide an alert to a monitor.
I wanted to ask Greg Hull, are those systems that we heard of, the motion detection, the smarter systems, are they beginning to be introduced on some of the systems you are involved with?
The technology is indeed advancing, and in fact we have some systems here in the United States that are moving towards that. We have New Jersey Transit that is moving to software applications to their surveillance equipment to enable them to be alerted when unusual activities are taking place and when something is left that doesn't belong within the environment.
Is it fair to say, though, that there are a lot of systems, and as I understand, for example, the New York City subway system, got to be considered a target at this point, a lot of cameras in stations, but none yet on the subway cars?
That's correct. The older the system, the more difficult it is to retrofit, the more costly, in fact, it is to retrofit. But certainly over the last decade and certainly since 9/11, we have seen an increasing number of transit agencies move towards the greater installation of cameras in their facilities, onboard trains, and onboard buses as well.
And again, we were talking with the woman from Chicago who said those monies came from Homeland Security, yet there is a great to-do right now over who's going to pay for these kind of surveillance systems. Right now, Homeland Security doesn't want to pay for them.
Well, there is a concern because public transit is, in fact, public. We are reliant upon funding support through the federal government. Since 9/11, there has only been $250 million come towards the public transit industry for security, whereas we've seen over $18 billion provided to the aviation industry. And while we certainly don't deny the need to support aviation security, we in the public transit industry transport over 16 times the number of trips on a daily basis.
Greg Hull, thank you very much for being with us. Greg Hull, Director of Operations Safety and Security with the American Public Transportation Association. We're going to ask Brian Jenkins to stay with us for a couple of more questions on security cameras and the fight against terrorism. When we come back from a break, we'll also be asking about the appointment today of John Bolton, a recess appointment to be the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, and Rafael Palmeiro of the Baltimore Orioles tested positive for steroids. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now we're concluding our conversation about security cameras and terrorism. Our guest is Brian Jenkins, director of the National Transportation Security Center at the Mineta Transportation Institute in San Jose, California. And Brian Jenkins, we've been talking about the use of security cameras as a possible deterrent and or also their use in investigating crimes. Do they have other uses?
Yes, they do. One important use is in diagnosis, that is, in figuring out when an event occurs, exactly what is happening. For example, in the 1995 attack on the Tokyo subways, in which the attackers used sarin, one of the difficulties encountered was really trying to figure out what was going on. The operators had information from the stations that something was happening. Initially, they thought it was a bomb. That clearly was not the case. But had they had a complete television coverage of those stations, they would have been able to more rapidly diagnose that those trains were carrying some type of noxious substance that was causing passengers to become ill.
Similar.
So diagnosis is an important contribution as well.
I would say similarly, in the first moments after the bombs in London, there were concerns that it was a fire rather than a bomb, and clearly managing the information that comes in is just as important as getting the information in.
It is, and indeed an ability to make a rapid diagnosis that will potentially save lives and at the very least minimize disruption is one of the utilities of these cameras. With regard to deterrence, I mean, obviously, as we've seen in London, cameras by themselves are not going to deter the most determined terrorist. I mean, those who are on their way to suicide don't particularly care if they have their pictures taken. But in fact, if we can drive terrorists in the direction of being suicide terrorists, that is, if we can raise the bar so that only the most determined fanatics will get through, that in itself is an achievement.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Jay. Jay calling us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yes. My question is, could that information that is being obtained by those cameras, if it was released to the public like the lady from Chicago said, you know, where people could watch the traffic and so forth, could those cameras be used to commit a crime in such as finding out the daily routes of a bank courier or of an armored truck?
I suppose if sensitive information like that coming through cameras, that in fact could be used to facilitate the reconnaissance, the casing of a target by criminals. And that's certainly a good point to think about as we contemplate the issue of whether or not we should use web cameras and involve more individuals in the surveillance process, that we have to make sure that we're not at the same time giving away sensitive information.
In London, they showed multiple pictures around the internet, things all over London. I was wondering if say people in public are not always who they seem to be. Maybe there's someone in the witness protection program, and now his picture is on the internet strictly by chance. He just happened to be at this place when something took, like the bombings took place, and that information is posted on the internet. I was wondering, why wouldn't there be more controls put on some information like that?
Jay, you have an interesting mind to come up with the angles that in fact people do have to think about. Look, the technology itself provides enormous capabilities. Provide some advantages to security, but at the same time we know that criminals are very, very skillful also in exploiting new technology. And so any deployment of this new technology raises the issue that people may exploit this for the wrong reasons.
Jay, thanks very much for the call, and we'll keep your identity private in case anything strange happens in the police call.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye, Jay. And finally, Brian Jenkins, to some degree, we do give up our rights to privacy when we are in public spaces, subways, parks.
I'm not sure what the expectations are of privacy in a public place. Certainly, the deployment of cameras in private space would be highly objectionable. But, you know, we talk about the 6,000 cameras in the London subways. Had London deployed 6,000 policemen, it would not raise a privacy issue. I think there's a point made by one of your earlier callers, which is correct. The camera is merely a technological substitute for a policeman on the beat. And since we don't have that many policemen, we can certainly the United Kingdom doesn't have 4 million policemen to deploy. We can gain some utility from the deployment of the cameras.
Brian Jenkins, as always, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Brian Jenkins, senior advisor to the president of the RAND Corporation. He joined us by phone from his office in Santa Monica, California. When we come back, Ambassador Bolton.